There was no ready-made plan, he assured them. There was one, that was one of the reasons he was meeting with them and other workers, to gradually put together some ideas based upon what they wanted, along with some of his own. One of these was a farm worker census, he went on, passing around some self-addressed 3x5 cards with the lines on the back for the name, address of the worker, and for what he considered a just hourly wage. The idea was an instant hit. Always before, one worker said, others had decided what he deserved, what he deserved. Now he himself was being consulted. It's like letting us vote, he said, on what we think. When asked what Caesar would do with the census, he explained that in the future, the workers would use it in demanding their rights before the appropriate government boards. A few days later, for the first time in history, a group of farm workers, including Caesar, would sit on a committee of the Industrial Welfare Board to determine the wage for women and minors in agriculture. But of equal importance, Caesar added, the census would start a farm worker's file for future content. For future contact. Many workers had already mailed the cards back along with short notes, urging him on, wishing him good luck. Caesar had immediately rushed out and commissioned these to form committees to speed up the census and spread the word of the council through the valley. Caesar called for more questions. Immediately, one of the workers asked if it was true that growers were going to bring the braceros back to the valley. They had had them and then they got rid of them. They were afraid, they heard they were going back. The question was asked in fear, and Caesar pounced. It could very well be true, he said. Such a move would be right in line with the great trick the growers had been playing on the workers for the past 100 years, enticing wave after wave of immigrants into this country to guarantee there'd always be more workers than work, and thus ensure complete control of the workforce by the growers. This was their biggest problem, he said, reminding them of what had happened when the braceros had gone back to Mexico temporarily after World War II. For a brief period, the grower had had to pay a little more. Then the illegals had been lured in, and it was right back where it had been before, with five hands for every job and the grower making it all. To keep out the illegals and other outsiders, he said, we have to get good laws and see they're enforced. That'll be one of the chief purposes of the association. No one spoke. Then there's the labor contractor, he said, watching him closely. We all know how he used this. That's right, one of them rumbled. The dirty, rotten, blood-sucking robbers. That did it. For a while, it was one long, unbroken litany, one voice picking it up the instant another had finished. No matter how little we make, he takes his bite. Yeah, $2.50 interest on a $5 loan. $1 a day to ride a stinking bus. You ought to pay us to ride, so wobbly and old it hardly holds the road, unbolted benches sliding all around. You work half your life for the same damn guy, then one morning here comes Mr. Illegal, young and full of beans, busting a gut to make a few cents more for himself and the boss, and there goes your job. You want to work, you got to slip in something. And with us women, it isn't only money. I know, Caesar broke in angrily, and that labor contract is going to be one of our first targets. When the association becomes a power in the valley, we'll set up our hiring halls where the workers can come to be dispatched to the ranches. That'll knock those dirty little puppets out of the way so we can spend full time going after the guy who really pulls the strings. They all nodded knowingly as Caesar slid into the next topic. It's no secret the grower pays us little enough. His glance went for their eyes but failed to catch them. Well, a faint smile touched his lips. At least we know we don't get too much. Their eyes still wandered as though they had long since worn out that old thing. He tried again. We all know whenever a day goes by, he doesn't rub our noses in the dirt. After a moment, so soft it scarcely broke the silence, came the voice of one of the women. No field toilets, so you squat among the vines. That got them going again. In the summer, no cool drinking water, just soup and a big drum with scum around the edge, a rusty beer can for the whole crew to drink from. They send you into the field right after they spray the poison. No time to rest. You stretch your back or light up a smoke and he's right on your tail. One more time and you pick up your pay. You make a complaint, you're fired on the spot. You go to work in the morning, you never know you'll have a job at the end of the day. They could have gone on all night, but here Caesar cut in, explaining when the workers had their own association, many of these things would be changed. They'd be able to stand up to the grower, he said, demand an end to the injustices they've been suffering for so many years. But all that, he said, will come only after a long time. and all the hard work and suffering that goes into organizing and struggling with the growers for our contract. He explained what that meant and asked the question. They all sat watching him in rapt attention till a soft-voiced woman near the wall began again. When you're sick, there's no work as in the winter. We run up such big bills we have to spend the rest of the year paying them off. But I guess, she lowered her eyes, there's no way the association could. Oh, yes, there is, Caesar came in. We could have what they call a credit union. It's like a workers' bank. During the season, each worker loans a little to the bank and learns to save that way, and even if it's only a tiny amount. Then in the winter, the bank makes loans to the worker at very low interest. Or when there's a death, another woman half whispered, and you have to go begging from door to door for money to bury the one you love. For that, Caesar broke in, there could be group burial insurance. There's a law now where a lot of people all doing the same kind of work can all join a burial plan together through their own organization and pay a little each month to cover all the members of the family. At this, the three women exchanged quick looks. Many of the men who work in the field die young. Or how about when you have to go to the welfare or the county hospital, asked the third woman, they turn you down. Or you get hurt on the job and the grower won't help you get your compensation. Would such things be the business of the association? Caesar nodded. The association could set up service programs in different parts of the valley to give the workers the backing they need to fight the agencies. It wouldn't take too long to set up such a program. How long? Asked one of the women. Caesar spread his hands, palms up. As long as it takes to find the people who are really interested. The best way to do this is in the homes, like here tonight. He paused, glancing, he's going to give it to them now. He paused, glancing at each of them. Who among you would be willing to call a few people together to your house so I could come and talk to them? After a moment's silence, the rumbler broke in again. Well, it's a great idea, Mr. Chavez, he said. The only trouble, it just won't work. The growers are too powerful.
Yeah.
Okay. Most of the others began to nod solemnly. But over by the wall, a soft-voiced woman and her husband had their heads together, whispered. Now, and for the rest of the meeting, Caesar seemed to be speaking mainly to them. I think that's where we make our mistake, he began gently, making ourselves believe the growers are more powerful than they really are. It's true, they're powerful, all right? But if the movement fails, it won't be because the growers are powerful enough to stop it. It'll be because the workers refuse to use their power to make it go. Probably there's no one in this room who is willing to help. Caesar's eyes traveled from one of them to another. Probably not even in this barrio, he went on. But I know that somewhere in Tulare County, I'll find one who is willing. That's all I need, just one. Because that one will take me to others who feel the same, and they'll make a workers' committee for this county. And when we have such committees in each important county in the state, we'll call them all together in Fresno and map the future course of La Casa. He rose now, putting his materials in order. The workers came up to shake his hand, some of them even reaching for a few of the census cards as they filed out, until only the soft-voiced woman and her husband remained. I am one of few words, the man began, eyes shining, but I like what you said tonight, Mr. Chavez, and there's some boys on my crew I think would like it too. If I got them together over my house one night, you think you could take the time to come and tell them about it? I must tiempo que vive, Caesar nodded, gripping the man's shoulder. It was an ancient Mexican teacher, meaning there's more time than life. Well, the rest of it. But that's a sort of a classical house meeting because it gets over the various problems that come up and the way you bring the problems out of the people and the answers that you could provide right there for someone so they immediately establish confidence in your ability to help them in some way. Because if they think they're blowing off and you don't really know what you're talking about, you know what's going to happen. So that's why it's good to, when you go, to know what resources there are in the community that you can help them with their problems on.
And then too, like that, not to be discouraged if you don't get too many volunteers.
That's right. See, he only, the rest of them, well, you know, they were willing to stay around the edge, sort of flirt around the edge, the rest of those farm workers that were at that meeting. But one of them took the plunge, and that's all he needed.
And like that shows that just because everybody has complaints, that doesn't mean
they're all going to help. But, you see, later you can get them. You can just get your hooks into them a little bit. And see that, what that also shows is that, something that I was going to bring out later, that his first and the hardest part of the resistance that Caesar came up against when he first started organizing was among the workers themselves. A lot of people think, oh, well, that was during the 60s, you know, when everybody wanted to join everything, and you know, the workers just blocked into the organization. Caesar didn't have to do anything. They just, you know, he just was like a honeypot. They all came rushing. Well, they didn't. He had to just go out and tug and haul all over the state. So did Dolores, like Lord Manuel, so on. Okay, then we'll go eat, huh? Okay, Paul? Just before we broke up, we were talking about how Caesar got started organizing. And I read you that. That was sort of a sample of the way he conducted house meetings all through the valley. Of course, that wasn't the only thing he did, was to hold house. That was the main tool that he used, but the way they started during the summer, see, he actually began the whole thing in April, and then it was only another couple of months until summer, and everybody was out of school, and the ones that Polly started to work, and Helen was working part-time, and Caesar would work in the morning some job, and Helen would work in the morning at the Georgia, and then they all come home and eat, and then while Helen was fixing lunch, Caesar would run off a lot of these cards, these postcards I told you about, and together with leaflets that went along with them. And then they'd make a beeline for the nearest town, say like Ridge Grove or Pixley or Early Mart or Porterville and so on, or down below, Wasco, McFarland, and so on. And on the way, whenever they saw crew of workers near the edge of the road in the field, why, they'd stop and run out into the fields real fast before they got thrown out, and talk to the workers for a little bit and hand them out these cards along with the leaflets, and get them to have the foreman weren't around. Well, they'd talk to them for a little while, have a house meeting right out in the field. But ordinarily, the foreman wasn't that far away. So then they'd go on to town. And while Helen and the kids were distributing the leaflets door to door in the barrios, why, Caesar would, well, he'd go to the barber shop or the grocery store or the bar or whatever, out in the park, and talk to anybody that he could talk to. And sometimes he'd run on to a group of farm workers fixing a car at the side of the road. He had a house meeting right there at the side of the road, telling the people the same sort of stuff that he was telling them at the house meetings, and trying always to find that one person in each town, at least one person, so he could sort of turn over the commission them, as they said, commission them to be in charge of the barrio. And gradually he managed to meet, well, literally thousands of, as I mentioned in there, of farm workers scattered around the counties. Meantime, of course, Dolores was working up in the northern part of the state, around from Stockton to Lodi, and then down to Modesto. And Manuel had come over, and he was working full time, helping Caesar. And I think the first place he went over was to Corcoran. And he began to make some headway, but he also ran into more obstacles, more kinds of problems that worked against him. Another one, of course, was the labor contractors themselves around Delano. The woods were full of labor contractors. Well, it's still around there, you know, Pancho, I forgot his last name, huh? What's Pancho's last name? It's present, I mean, the
hotel?
No, the head of the city council in Delano.
Oh, Frank, or Herrera.
Herrera. Yeah. And the chief of police, Espinoza, Al Espinoza, you see, well, those were a couple of the farm labor contractors, and there were several more, of course, right there in Delano. And they got wind of the fact that Caesar was going around talking to workers, and they didn't know what it was all about, but they had their suspicions because they knew what a good organizer he was for the CSO, because he'd already organized them inside the CSO, you see, several years before. They came in, well, not because he was making an extra effort to get labor contractors in the CSO, but they were attracted to the power base there in the Colonial. And so they tried to make life miserable for him, you know, and turn the people that they knew against him. And the AWOC, Agricultural Workers Organizing Committee, that was the AFL-CIO union that had been organized several years before in Stockton by, well, actually by Dolores and one of the priests up there and the CSO chapter in that area. And then they got the money from, they got the organizing the money from AFL-CIO, and that's how that organization was set up. But over the years, they got, about $2.5 million from the AFL-CIO, and, well, never accomplished hardly anything. It was run by a guy by the name of Smith, who had never had any experience at all in farm work. He'd been an auto worker, steel worker. He thought the way to organize farm workers was to organize the labor contractors. And then, once they became union members, they wouldn't let anybody on their buses, any workers on their buses, unless they joined the union. Well, you can imagine how many workers they got in the union that way. I thought it was, you know, a contractor gimmick. Well, that's about all it was. And, well, it was a little more than that. And, but probably, oh well, so they used these AWOC organizers, when they found out that Caesar was holding these meetings with farm workers, they knew it wasn't CSO anymore, and because some of them had formerly belonged to CSO, like Hector Vatia, for instance. And so they started following him around and trying to turn the workers against him. They'd send their people into the house meetings that Caesar would hold and try and disrupt them and so forth. But fortunately, Caesar was well known all through the valley because he had worked for so long with CSO, and they knew him as the person who had helped the old timers get the pensiones, the pension. And so they had a lot of confidence and respect for him. So Caesar would just turn the floor over to these AWOC organizers, and they'd try and turn the people against him. And the people would kick them out, listen to Caesar. So it was just an extra headache for him. But his biggest headache, and then some of the members of his own family were opposed to the idea. I don't mean Elena, but, you know, he had other parts of members of the family there, and they'd get a hold of Richard, some of them, and say, hey, why don't you talk to that brother of yours? Well, what's the matter with him anyway, tearing up and down the valley, holding, jackassing around, holding these house meetings and so forth? Why didn't he get a decent job and go to work? What's he trying to prove? Why don't you talk to him, Richard? So he said, well, what is he, crazy? Local? And so he had that to contend with too, but then he gradually managed to straighten him out on it. Not that they didn't help him, they just wondered what he was going to Cada loco con su tema. Well, that was, when's he going to get rid of his tema, you know? And, but his biggest problem was an economic problem. See, as I told you, he only had little money when he left the CSO. And he couldn't earn too much money just working part-time. It helped, of course, but see, he was having to spend an awful lot of money just on gasoline, oil and gas for the car, just tearing all over the place, you know. And He did get some food from the workers themselves. That, you know, they'd bring in corn, fruit, and once in a while a chicken or something from the places where they worked. And then people on relief would give the Chavez food that they couldn't eat. You know, well, the Chavez family wouldn't eat it ordinarily if they could afford anything better themselves, but they couldn't, so they ate it. And the relatives helped out on that, but they still were about half hungry most of the time. And one period, I think it was that first or the second winter, most of the kids had these malnutrition sores because they weren't getting, you know, enough to eat or the right kind of food to eat. And Caesar tells a story about one time when he was working over in Corcoran. He was trying to hold a house meeting at the home of Julio Hernandez. That was Julio and his wife. Probably most of you know him and her. But he couldn't hardly keep his mind on the house meeting because on top of the stove was a big plate of fried chicken, just, you know, coming clear up over the top of the bowl. He had an awful time getting through the house meeting because he kept. His stomach kept growling and so on. So when he was all through, he went out to the car and he started. He was planning to go back to Delano and get some beans or something when he got back home. But he just kept thinking about that chicken. He got in the car, but he couldn't bring himself to turn the key or whatever it was to get it, or maybe in those days he had to push down on the starter to get it started. Because he kept thinking about that chicken. So finally, he just, without realizing hardly, he was out of the car knocking on the door again. And Tina, Julio's wife, said, "Oh, what's the matter, Caesar? Did you forget something?" He said, "Yeah, I think I forgot my ballpoint pen." Well, he had the pen in his hand, you know. So she said, "I don't think you did. It's not under the table." He said, "Maybe it's under the stove." And walked over by the stove where that chicken is, you know. "Oh, here it is," he said. He goes down and then, like, pick up. Comes up like that, "Wow, chicken sure does smell good." "Yeah, well, what's the matter, Caesar? Are you hungry?" He said, "Well, I haven't had anything to eat since last night." So, well, of course, you know, the upshot of that was they fed him some chicken and then they turned around and had another house meeting, you know, which was a much better house meeting than the first one because this time they were into it. They were giving something to the organizer instead of getting it from him. But he, as you probably know, it suddenly dawned on him that this was a good organizing tool. He wouldn't have chosen it if he'd had his druthers as a way of organizing, but since he had to have it anyway, he made the best of it. And from that time on, he sort of got over his pride about begging, you know. And whenever he got hungry, he'd just stop at somebody's house where he'd already contacted him and asked him if they had any coffee. Well, you know what that meant. They knew what it meant, too. And he was hungry. He didn't want just a cup of coffee. He wanted something to eat. So while he was eating, he just got, you know, made another connection with that farm worker and the farm worker with him. By September of 1962, as I mentioned in there, he had personally met well over 2,000 workers and had set up these little committees in about 87 barrios throughout the state. Dolores had been doing the same thing. Manuel had been doing the same thing. And they called together the hardcore of the leadership in each of the barrios all throughout state where they've been working in Fresno. On September 30th of 1962, at a place called the German Hall there. And in those days, they even had a hard time getting a hall to meet in. They tried to get the church to help them there in Fresno, and they wouldn't do it. This probably is. Yeah. So they managed to get this other hall, and they spent the whole, I guess there were about, well, over 200 farm workers there from all over the state. And they spent the whole day sort of hammering out a program, and it's more or less letting Caesar know what they wanted included in the bylaws and constitution of the National Farm Workers Association. That's the name they decided on. And that's when, one point in the meeting, Caesar called on Manuel to come up, and they had a big sheet on the wall about that big with a pull cord on one end of Manuel. And Caesar called Manuel up and he says, well, folks, Manuel's got a surprise for you. Manuel pulls the pull cord, and wow, the thing falls down. There's the Welga flag up there. That's the first time anybody had seen it. You know, all this red up there, and they all they saw this thing, probably thought of a communist organization or something. And, no, but they liked it, of course, very much. And they adopted that as right there at the meeting as their flag. And they also voted to that they were going to have a program, which
was 1963.
And they put together a program which included the death benefit plan at $350 a month per family, which would entitle the family, the whole family, the husband died, the wife would get $1,000, the wife died, the husband would get $500, and the kids died, it'd be $250 for each of them. That was the first death benefit plan. And then there was money, there would be money left over from that to help the organizers stay alive. That was how the workers were going to pay for the union. Remember I started off by telling you that was one of the things that Caesar was insisting on? Well, he found a way by which sort of a semi-painless way by which the workers could pay for their own union. And as well as a way of getting the money from them instead of having the straight dues, which is hard to collect, by having the death benefits, if the family wanted to get death benefits, they had to pay that money every month or else they'd be, flipped off after a certain length of time. So the wives made sure that the husbands paid their, because the wives have always been worried, about that money. If so many husbands die, and that was one of the things that attracted them to the union, that this was a union that was going to be for the families as well as for the farm worker himself or herself. And then they set up, they agreed to have they voted to have a credit union, federal credit union, and a service center. That's when the service center program was decided on, and right after that meeting was put into effect, both in Delano and up in Stockton, where Dolores was. And then they also agreed that they needed some kind of a cooperative, beginning with car accessories like tires and so forth, and hopefully getting into other types of cooperatives, housing cooperatives and so forth. So they were thinking about some of the things then, way back then, that are just beginning to, for instance, the Akbayani village, they didn't envision that, but they were thinking about some kind of a housing plan. So for the next 3 years, all three of them were tearing all over the place, finding people who wanted to participate in the union by taking out their death benefits and organizing more and more people throughout the state. Dolores, of course, moved down to Delano, and so they all lived there together. And it went on more or less like that. They didn't get involved in any strikes right up until, I've forgotten whether, I think it was the beginning of 65 or the end of 64, they got into a strike in the Roses. And that was sort of an inconclusive one. They won a wage increase on it, but they didn't get the contract or anything. Well, then, well, they didn't. They wanted to stay as they even wanted to stay away from that. But the workers, more or less, that was involving Camacho. You know, that was when he first got involved.
I thought it was a Martin Wrench. That was
the one that that Gilbert stood up on the top of his car and said, "Hey, you're on strike. Come on out." talk to him through the bullhorn. What's the matter with these guys? Didn't you realize you're on strike?
My family was involved on strike.
Oh, yeah? Is that right? Yeah. So, at any rate, then the big one came when the members of the National Farm Workers Association went to work and they found Filipino pickets in front of some of the ranches where they worked, and they had been trying to get closer to each other. In Delano, Dolores knew you know, the Filipino leader?
Larry.
As a matter of fact, she had recruited him in the old days up in Stockton in the first attempts of AWOC to do anything up there. So they were quite friendly, and they'd been trying to make plans for, you know, a joint operation anyway. Well, along comes the strike then of the Filipino workers, and the Chicano workers brought the news in, and they took a vote. They didn't want to go through the Filipino line and break the brothers' strike, and they took the vote on the 16th of September of 65 and voted unanimously to back the Filipino strike, and sent out letters. Caesar and the union sent out letters to all the growers asking them to sit down and negotiate, and of course none of them replied. So whatever ranches the Filipinos hadn't already struck, well, the NFWA struck. They had pretty close to 40 ranches, the 40 biggest ranches on strike at one time. And they were, those strikes were recognized, certified by the Department of Employment of the state as being legitimate. Certified? I don't know whether it was or not. Can't answer that.
The first strike of Lena was one of the first strikes. It was the first strike that certified
them. I have a hunch that AWOC got some of their little strikes certified, but I don't know. Maybe that appears in that book, So Shall You Grieve. They probably tell that.
Must be one
in. Yeah. So, I forgot to say that the founding convention of NFWA met there in Stockton. They voted $50 a week for their organizer. Well, that was a laugh. I think it was $50 a week for each organizer. Well, there was only about $17. There was only about $17 in the treasury, so they never got anything. You know, if you don't have to worry about it, you can vote people millions of dollars for salary. You don't ever have to pay it. So, they kept on, did the best they could. And but when they went on strike, of course, that was a whole new ball game. You know, they couldn't support the strikers on a little bit of food they were getting from the workers and so forth. So Caesar and Eliseo and several others started tearing all over the state, going out to all the campuses, colleges, universities around the state, getting students to give up their lunch money, getting as much money as they could out of Chris Hartmeyer and the migrant ministry and from whatever labor union locals that would help throughout the country. But that helped a little bit. But at least it helped to support a soup kitchen. And that's about it. Soup kitchen, and then caravans began to come down from San Francisco and up from Los Angeles with food and clothing and so forth. And they opened a big Quonset hut out there near the 40 acres.
And San Diego.
And San Diego. Quonset hut?
That's what
the old one.
Huh?
What was that?
A Quonset hut, one of these, you know, big wartime things they used during the war. And filled it up with, well, clothes and canned food and sacks of beans and so forth. And right next door to it was a little restaurant, a little eating place, you know. And that's where they used to come and eat, strikers. And they were, well, you know, they were trying their best to picket as many of these ranches as they could, but they were, you know, they had to be more or less mobile picket lines. They were all hooked up to a central car radio deal with the main switch deal in the little office that they had on Albany Street there, the original office of NFWA. And then a number of these cars had radios, and they'd go out and find out where the scabs were, and then they'd radio back to the office, and how'd it go? A crew was dispatched out to where the scabs were, and they'd pick it out there and talk to them all day long, or as long as they could. So that's how the strike started. And then they were trying to follow the trucks, find out where the trucks were taking the grapes, and they followed the trains, and Dolores and a group of workers went down to the Center of Produce in Los Angeles there on 7th Street and picketed down there, and Gilbert got one of his legs broken at that time, and they knocked him off the floating platform, and they'd come up, those teamsters down the lumpers that come up with their trucks, you know, they haul the stuff that's got a metal along the edge of the bottom, and come up and hit them in the shins with it as they went by. And until they saw that they were nonviolent and that they really meant business and so forth, then they made friends with them. They used to bring coffee and donuts and so forth. So even that, well, those were good teamsters after they found out.
How many people were instructed?
Pardon?
How many people
went out? They figured about 5,000 altogether. Now, of course, you know, a lot of them went back after they gave up hope and so forth. But they got an awful lot of them out in the first few weeks.
Were you helping out at that time?
No, I came the following year. I'll get to that in a minute. That's my favorite part. Gilbert, I mean, brother, Leroy was negotiating for it at that time. He'd raised a lot of the money to buy it up in San Francisco and down in L.A.
Who's that?
The 48, Leroy Chatfield.
Most people
wouldn't
remember Brother Gilbert.
That's right, yeah. And where was he? So they, after they had after they'd been, you know, doing whatever they could to try and stop the grapes, they finally could see that, well, the workers were going back to work, and they got injunctions against them. DiGiorgio got an injunction. Several of the other growers got an injunction to limit the number on the picket line, make it ineffective and all that. So they, well, what the hell can we do? And finally, I think it was Jim Drake said, well, why don't we do what the blacks used to do? Why don't we have a boycott? Maybe we can make a boycott work. So, well, what the hell we got to lose, you know? We might as well try it. So they went on a boycott against Shenley. They picked out one of the large growers, wine grape grower, and who had a boycottable product, you know, Shenley liquors and so on. And they went on so-called boycott, and that's about it was so-called, because they just got teenagers and whatever they could get their hands on, a few farm workers here and there, but, you know, mostly people down from the city. And they bummed rides back to places like New York. They just got out on the highway. They didn't have any money to send them by plane or train or even bus. I know there was one very young couple of the The boy was only 17 years old, and I think the girl was 18, and they thumbed their way clear on back to Chicago or some place back there. But that's what they were all doing. That's how the boycott started, and nothing. Didn't have any money. But it began to scare Shenley a little bit. But Caesar wanted to scare him an awful lot, and he wanted to scare a lot of other people. That's when they decided to have the march to Sacramento to publicize, for one thing, to publicize the whole strike nationally, because they were getting some publicity here in California, but they weren't reaching the national public that they wanted. So they planned the march, 300-mile march to Sacramento in early 1966. Scheduled to arrive on Easter Day in the state capitol. And Manuel Chavez was the advance man. He'd go ahead from town to town before the marchers would get there and line up a room and board and a place to have a meeting. And then the marchers would get to the town, and the town people would, you know, take them into tow, and they'd have a meeting that night, and they'd tell them, you know, and they went to all the towns where the Chicanos lived, where there were barrios, you know, in order to get them closer and closer to the strike, get more and more farm workers involved in some way. And that's what they did. In other words, they used it as an organizing device, too, to spread La Huelga to more and more workers as they went on up the state. And it did, and they got lots of publicity. The TV machines were out there. CBS and NBC and all the rest of them, and they got it in the newspapers and the New York Times and all over the country. And when they got to Sacramento on Easter Day, well, what started out with, I think they had about 100 people to start at, 75 to 100, and there were 10,000 people there in front of the governor's, well, you know, in front of the big state capitol building. And including, many big honchos from organized labor and the church and so forth, who all made speeches. Went on all afternoon. By the time poor Caesar got a chance to speak, why, half the people had to leave. These guys were so long-winded. And the governor didn't show. It was the stupidest mistake he could have made. He was running for election that year. That's Brown's father.
Junior's father,
yeah. And
what was his reason for not showing?
Oh, he had to spend Easter with his mother down at Palm Springs. He could have done that. He could have just flown up and then right back. You know, he could have put in an appearance, but like a jerk. You know, well, that's why he lost the election. He's too much of a jerk to hold the voters. But it was, in one way, it was good, because by doing that, he turned a lot of people against him. It was a real snub to this infant union, you know, and 10,000 people saw it. So he was running for election. So he had something, he had one big or two strikes against him right there on the part of an awful lot of people in California. So he had to produce something later on, and he did, and I'll get to that in a minute. But before they arrived in Sacramento, about two or three days before they arrived, Shenley caved in and agreed to recognize the union. They had had enough of the boycott, even though it didn't amount to all that much. And plus the fact that everybody on the line was carrying these signs, boycott Shenley, boycott whatever the Shenley products were. And these were getting on television all over the United States, you see. So Shenley caved in, agreed to recognize the union. And so then they just turned the signs around and put Boycott of Georgia on the other side of the signs, and then they got those up before the TV cameras. So DeGiorgio came out with a statement in the press saying that they would give serious consideration to having a secret ballot election under certain unacceptable conditions, like no boycott, no strike during the harvest, and all their wonderful conditions. But at least, that's the first time that any grower of any magnitude had ever agreed to do anything, So it was a tremendous, tremendous victory. Shanley was the, that's the thing, the main thing to remember about that was that Shanley was the first, represented the first time that we used the boycott. As far as I know, they didn't have an injunction against us. Giorgio got the injunction. That was the first injunction that we got against us. And that was the second boycott. We went out on a boycott against the Giorgio and threw lines around a number of his ranches and so on. And began to hold negotiations with the vice president of the Giorgio company and their attorney in Fresno. And the upshot of all this was, though, that they began to, some monkey business while we were doing the negotiating, they began to play around with the Teamsters. This was the first time that the Teamsters came into the picture. The reason that I'm mentioning these various ranches, is because they represent first times in the record of the union, the first boycott, the first injunction, the first time we came up against the Teamsters there with the Giorgio, and we woke up one morning, found out the Teamsters were inside. We couldn't get inside the Giorgio ranch. They were inside passing out their green authorization cards. And so we had to get at all the workers in there as they went out to work in the morning on these trucks. We'd have rolled up leaflets, and we'd throw them into each truck as it would go out of the ranch, and the workers would read. That was the morning newspaper for quite a while there. And the workers and a number of the foremen refused to sign these Teamster cards. And one of the oldest foremen, a woman by the name of what's her name? Huh? I'll think of it. She went back to New York. She was in the. I'll think of it. Her husband's name was Blackie. You remember?
Yeah.
Huh? You know what I mean. It's a very pretty name. I'll think of it. Well, she got fired. She was a poor lady. She got fired for signing workers up on our authorization cards instead of the Teamster authorization cards after she'd been working for the Giorgio for 25 years. And so in order to try and pull a trick on us and hold a secret ballot election while he pulled a phony election on us, supervised by himself, you know. This is just for your own, you don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, because it just shows the sort of chicanery they went in for. Huh? Yeah, like Larson's, right. It was set the pattern for that. And the guy that later became our friend, Monsignor Mahoney, was called down as the person that oversaw the election, you know. And what they did was to go out after they couldn't get the workers to vote the first time. They wouldn't get off the trucks to go in. They'd bring them up in the trucks out of the field, and the workers wouldn't get off the trucks. So then they'd send the trucks back to the fields again, and then they'd go out and pick them up two or three at a time in the pickups and bring them up and threaten them, and with loss of their jobs and so forth, they didn't go in and vote for the Teamsters.